This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. It is not October yet, but we are going to start rolling into some horror-type movies with Hotel Transylvania 2, and then a bonafide horror film, The Green Inferno. Also, a sort of light comedy, The Intern, and then some smaller stuff like Wildlike, Unbranded, and Meet the Patels. I'll also talk about the news, the trailer park, and my box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, as well as the Instagram handle fatguysatthemovies. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. The first thing I want to talk about is not actually about movies. It's about television. And I don't really cover television all that much unless it's something that really interests me or I really think it has a decent crossover with movies. In particular, the one I want to talk about is The Muppets. Now, this has caused a little bit of a hubbub because the new Muppets is kind of come under fire from multiple people, but mostly one particular group, because it uses, and I'm really reticent to say adult humor, because adult humor makes it sound like South Park. But it has some edgier humor, some double entendre, and some jokes in there that are maybe not G-rated, we'll say. Now, to be fair, multiple reviewing outlets, including like Time and Fortune, and even a friend of mine who writes for Forbes, Merrill Barr, he didn't complain about the edgy humor. He just didn't like it because he's a kid. He doesn't understand how things were back in the 70s. So he doesn't know why people like the Muppets in the first place. But that's Merrill. That's his own problem. But outlets like Time and Fortune have complained about, or actually taken issue with, it being a little bit more of grown-up humor. But in particular, 1 Million Moms, which is the organization that boycotts everything they can think of that has anything to do with, usually it has to do with lesbians or gays or something like that. Like, they boycotted Ellen, or they boycotted JCPenney's, I think, because they were advertising on Ellen's show. Forget the fact that Ellen is like the most popular talk show host since Oprah. They were just like, nope, she's a lesbian, so let's boycott her. They're a bit reactionary, and their name also isn't terribly accurate. It's like 10 or 20,000 moms, not a million moms. Sort of like the Million Man March that took place in Washington like 20 years ago, which did not have a million men involved. In The Muppets, they shoot it like the Muppets are running their own late night talk show. Miss Piggy is a star, Kermit's a showrunner. So in essence, it's very similar to the old Muppet show because Kermit is dealing with all the insanity of a nightly show and Piggy is a diva. And a lot of this stuff is true to the original feel. But it's ultimately the Muppets version of The Office. And to do that, you need to have it be a little bit more grounded and in reality. And these characters aren't on Sesame Street. They're real people. And if you go back to the original Muppet show, like in the 70s, they dealt with grown-up issues as well. I'm not just talking about, you know, stuff that would be considered edgy. There's a whole episode, I think it goes on for several episodes, where Floyd and the Electric Mayhem is trying to unionize, or at the very least, renegotiate their contract, and they're essentially striking, which is not something that kids are going to deal with. And Henson always said that the Muppets were supposed to be real people, and it's not necessarily a kiddie show. That's Sesame Street. If you want the kiddie stuff, it's Sesame Street. The Muppets always had their foot in the side of, a little bit more in the adult humor. Great example, I think it was a third season of The Muppet Show. Back in the 70s, they had Alice Cooper on the show. And Alice Cooper was trying to get Miss Piggy to sell her soul to the devil. What do you think the 1 million moms would think about that? That was the bona fide good old-fashioned Muppet Show from, what, mid-70s, late 70s? This is what the Muppets always were. There's apparently an episode that has Ralph the dog trying to trick Sam the Eagle into saying dirty words in a song. And that's funny. It's kind of Howard Stern nonsense. But to imply that the Muppets are these squeaky clean characters, they've never been. That's Sesame Street. this is the Muppets. And in fact, I went and watched the Muppets. I thought it was a hoot. I thought it was a lot of fun. And you may not like the humor, you may not like the delivery, but I mean, like, they made a joke about Fozzie was driving and he's talking about how he's dating and he was trying to, and he got this girlfriend. He says, you don't want to go on a website and you say a bear trying to find a relationship, you get a very different crowd than you expect. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Look, if you don't know what the slang term for bear is in the adult world, you're not going to be corrupted. It's a joke that exists only for people who know what it is. And if the kid already knows what that means, then the kid already knows what that means. So nobody's getting corrupted. But the bottom line is, if you don't want your kids watching the Muppets, be a responsible parent and just don't let them watch the Muppets. You don't have to let them watch it. Why I take issue with 1 million moms as opposed to Time and Fortune and my friend Meryl Barr from Forbes, who is, you know, railing against the show, they're just reviewing it. 1 million moms is calling for the boycott of it. I'm like, no, if you don't want to watch it, just don't watch the show. But we're stepping pretty close to some bizarre slacktivism censorship nonsense to try and stop a show and take it off the air. For example, I hate reality TV. I think reality TV is the bane of television today. I wish E would just never put a Kardashian on tape again. I'm not going to boycott it. If people want to watch the Kardashians make absolute messes of their lives, they can go see that. I'm not going to watch it. But I'm not going to tell people to boycott it. If you like the show, watch the show. That's why I take issue with 1 million moms. You guys need to get a surgeon to get something physically removed. For those who watch The Muppets and got all those jokes, you know what I'm talking about. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Peanuts. This is, of course, a CGI animated version of our beloved characters from Charles Schulz, coming to the big screen November 6th.
Hey, Kay, look, there's a new kid moving in.
I just hope this new kid has never heard of me.
Charlie Brown needed a miracle.
I just need to know the secret for doing something great.
What he got was Snoopy.
No dog!
I've always loved Charlie Brown and the Peanuts. I remember watching The Great Pumpkin and A Christmas Time Charlie Brown, all those specials before VHS even, where the only chance you had to see these is when they broadcast them. And I remember we'd get them, we'd be in our chairs watching them. It was like the highlight of the week to watch those things. I've loved the Peanuts for years. I've grown to appreciate them even more as an adult. It looks like they are retaining the charm of the original Peanuts gang. They're not trying to make them hip or cool. They're the good old-fashioned Peanuts, and I'm actually looking forward to this. It looks really cute. It's interesting. They're sort of playing with mythology with Snoopy moving next door, but that's okay. I'm not going to complain about that. The next one I want to talk about is The Big Short. It opens December 23rd.
Michael, how are you?
I found something really interesting.
The whole housing market is propped up on these bad loans. They will fail.
The housing market is rock solid.
It's a time bomb. Keeps on
raining. All the banks were having a big old party. A few outsiders saw it when no one else could.
Whole world economy might collapse.
This is, of course, going to take us back to 2008 during the whole financial crisis, and it is based on a nonfiction book by the guy who did Moneyball. What kind of blows my mind about this is it's directed by Adam McKay. I mean, the guy who gave us Anchorman and the other guys is directing this movie, which looks like it's up for Oscar contention. I mean, it opens December 23rd. It's a big movie. It's got some big stars, not just somebody from Anchorman like Steve Carell, but it's got Ryan Gosling, Christian Bale, Brad Pitt. I mean, this is a powerhouse cast. I'm very curious to see how this is because it's going to be the first one that has had some distance because we had stuff like Margin Call, which was a fantastic movie several years ago, but that was almost too close to the 2008 crisis. Now we can kind of look back, and yes, it's going to be through the filter of Hollywood, but you know what? I have no love for the people involved in crashing the economy. There was a lot of stupid behavior and greedy behavior. I'll say that right now. And I think there was a lot of misuse and abuse of the system and fraud. And I think this is going to kind of bring it to light. And it looks like it's going to be a pretty strong film. So I'm looking forward to that one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. We're going to hit some movies in the wild, including The Green Inferno and Wildlike when we return. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Back, guys, at the movies with Kevin Carr. Let's dive right into the movie reviews for this week. We're going to go into the wild in two different places, two totally different places on this earth. The first place we're going to go is the rainforest of Peru with The Green Inferno, Eli Roth's latest movie. A group of do-gooders head to Peru to save the rainforest and stumble onto a vengeful tribe of cannibals.
Peru is dangerous. We can't just go invade a country because they're doing something that we think is immoral.
I know. I just think I should be doing something about the rainforest.
Fire!
Why are they doing this? What are they going to do to us? We have to get out of here.
You know what this is?
This has a bit of a checkered past because Eli Roth shot this movie a while back and it was actually supposed to come out last year and it was pulled from distribution. No one ever got a real reason why. I don't know whether it didn't fit into the company's business plan or whether they thought it was too intense. I mean, you watch the trailers and it's like, oh, this is gonna just mess people up and people are gonna be walking out and it's gonna be the sickest and most crazy thing you've ever seen. It's not. Now, I mean, if all you've ever seen are PG movies and less, yeah, it's gonna be disturbing. But this is not that shocking of a film. I mean, it shows its hand throughout the entire movie. And after a handful of films by Eli Roth, I have come to believe that he's not very good. There are parts of this movie that are actually very effective, that actually work very, very well. I mean, the moments of horror, Eli Roth understands what makes scenes horrific. He understands how to make an audience squirm. He knows how to make things grisly. He knows how to build tension and suspense in very specific moments. But he doesn't know how actually to write a script. I think he stumbled onto some decently written stuff earlier in his career, like Cabin Fever and the Hostel movies, the first two at least. But this is, I mean, it is a hodgepodge of bad writing. There's some really terrible moments. And I'm not just talking dialogue. I'm talking character moments and things that happen that are supposed to be shocking and unnerving, but come off as campy and stupid. The basic gist is these people go into the jungle. They're trying to save the rainforest and save this tribe who then kidnap them and, you know, put them in a cage and it's waiting who's next, who's going to get eaten by the cannibals. But they have weird moments in this movie. Like, there's one scene where a girl, oh, I'm going to get sick, and she just defecates. She has some sort of intestinal bug. And I'm watching this going, this isn't horrific, or this is just uncomfortable to watch. Not in the way it's meant to be uncomfortable. Not in the way horror is supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to watch because it's poorly done. And that's the problem. There's other scenes in the movie, especially early on, where the writing is just so bad. And the acting is amazingly terrible by some of the actors in this film. I mean, it's some of the worst acting I've seen in a major wide theatrical release in a while. I honestly can't remember the last movie that I think was worse acted by the cast in general. I mean, some of them are okay. But it's like Eli Roth understands certain parts of horror very, very well. And there's other parts he's kind of just guessing on and putting two and two together and getting five when it comes to making his scenes unnerving and disturbing. It's a homage to Cannibal Holocaust, which was a notorious video nasty from the early 80s, who you heard the beautiful intro music from. Cannibal Holocaust was such a weird film because some people thought it was real. It got banned in some countries. And I think one of the things that bothered people more than the explicit content of the film, that original movie, was they actually hunted animals in the movie. They actually killed animals in the movie, in the making of the movie, which people don't like to see. I mean, because that's real animals getting harmed. Now, I've seen Cannibal Holocaust. I've seen the uncut version. And this one tries to play homage to it, but it sometimes hits the mark squarely on the head and it's perfect. And then there are times, about half the time, it just is almost Mystery Science Theater laughable. You know, I appreciate what Eli Roth is doing, and I appreciate the fact that he is keeping grisly horror alive in theatrical releases. But, I mean, this just seems like he's working his way through a travelogue of terror. He's done, you know, How Horrible It Is in the American South with Cabin Fever. He's done How Horrible It Is in War-Torn Eastern Europe with Hostel. He's done How Horrible It Can Be in Chile with Aftershock, which he just wrote and starred in. And now he's done How Horrible It Can Be in the Peruvian Rainforest, if you're attacked by cannibals. And if there's anything I took away from this movie, it's that you don't want to be the fat guy when you stumble into a tribe of cannibals. Ultimately, I have to say the Green Inferno, for as much hype as it had and buildup, I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is another one going into the wild, and that is Wildlike. After escaping her abusive uncle's clutches, a 14-year-old girl finds herself alone in the Alaskan wilderness trying to get back to Seattle.
It's Mackenzie. I'm calling for my mom.
She checked herself out.
Are you, like, in some kind of trouble or something?
11 a.m. to Seattle. Is that where you're from?
That's where I live.
I'm going to hike through the park for a few days.
I'm hiking, too.
We eat 100 yards from the tent. We don't make fires.
I know what I'm doing.
You have no idea.
How far can these things fly? Could this go, like, all the way to Seattle?
Well, are you ready to go home?
Whatever you do, don't run. Do not run.
This is a smaller release. It's getting very limited theatrical runs throughout the states. And, you know, it's better than how it's set up. I mean, it just seems like it's going to be an awkward relationship movie, because it's got this 14-year-old girl and she kind of tags along uninvited to Bruce Greenwood's character, who's just trying to go out in the wilderness and get away from everything, and she tags along. And it's them sort of getting to know each other. The biggest problem with this movie is it pulls its punches too much. Part of the thing is the setup is the girl, her mother is going into some sort of mental treatment or drug treatment. She sends her to Alaska to live with her uncle, and her uncle molests her. And so she escapes one day and just kind of runs into the wilderness and tries to get away from him. But the problem is that it kind of pulls its punches. You don't know how far, if it was actually, what actually happened between the two of them, just that she was uncomfortable. And I've seen this done in movies where, as much as I don't like to see that on screen, you gotta at least let the audience know what happened. If the audience is guessing the whole time, you know, maybe it's bad, maybe it's not. It's hard to muster the sympathy if it possibly maybe could have sort of happened. There has to be a definitive reason to get behind this girl and not make her somewhat reactionary, even though it's obviously what was going on, at least the advances that her uncle's making to her are very, very wrong. And this happens throughout. Bruce Greenwood's character never digs deep enough to find out what her problem in the past was. And it's like one of those movies that so much could be solved if people just talked about it. Ultimately, it's a beautiful looking movie. It's shot in Alaska. It's gorgeous. I've been to Alaska. You know, it's a gorgeous landscape. The characters are okay. What saved it is the chemistry between the actors more than the script itself. So I'm going to have to say that Wildlike ultimately kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for these reviews. I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hotel Transylvania 2 and The Intern. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continuing on into the movie reviews, we had Green Inferno in the last segment. That's a bona fide horror movie. I'm okay with dropping some horror movies in September. I'm not one of those people who gets so upset at prepping for the holiday season. Now, putting out Halloween stuff in July, that might be going a little too far. Putting out Christmas stuff in October bothers me because let's have Halloween have its chance. But I don't mind at the end of September, mid to late September, starting to put out Halloween stuff. I like that. I mean, it kind of gets ready to go. And then when October hits, you're fully into the function of it. And I've always been a big fan of horror movies and horror-related stuff. I mean, Hotel Transylvania 2 is not a horror movie. But I think these horror-related stuff are great to have leading into October because you don't want to drop it a week before Halloween because pretty much around early November, as much as I still like horror movies, it seems a little silly to release horror movies in November. That's you're getting ready for Christmas, Thanksgiving and Christmas. Let those have their time. So the next movie I want to talk about is Hotel Transylvania 2. Dracula's daughter from the first film marries her human boyfriend and they have a son. Soon Dracula worries the child isn't monster enough to keep him in Transylvania.
Ever since Johnny and Mavis had their little monster, I've been the happiest vampire in the world!
Are we sure he's a vampire?
Technically, you have until you're 5 to get your vampire fangs.
Oh, he'll get his fangs. He's just like me. Look at him!
Blah, blah, blah.
I don't say blah, blah, blah.
We've been talking about moving somewhere safer for Dennis.
If we get his fangs to come out, Mavis can't leave.
I remember when the first one came out, I think it was 3 years ago, pretty much on this same weekend. It was the end of September. And to me, even back then, I thought, well, this is a little early. Shouldn't this be like the first weekend in October? But that's okay. It's okay to have a movie release that's horror related before October. This kind of gets us going. This kind of oils the gears, so to speak. And I liked Hotel Transylvania, the first one. I thought it was cute. There's a lot of people out there who hate Adam Sandler. I don't think you're going to see the hatred for Adam Sandler coming out in this movie the way it did for Pixels. I mean, the critics are going to go after it. But Adam Sandler's kind of turning into what Nicolas Cage was a couple years ago. Nicolas Cage used to be a box office draw. He had some bad investments. And now he does any movie that comes his way because he needs to make some money. And the last hit that he had, the last bona fide real hit that Nicolas Cage had was The Croods, because he was just doing the voice. But he was probably cast in that years before that movie ever came out. Same thing with Hotel Transylvania. Adam Sandler has been tied to this movie. Well, the difference is, in this one, Sandler and his team, Hurley, he and Colvert, are the ones who are writing this. And he's got his hands pretty deep in this. But it's fun and it's charming. And so what? It's Adam Sandler. So what? It's Kevin James. This is not Grown Ups. This is not Jack and Jill. This is Sandler doing something very funny and very charming. And while I enjoyed the first one for what it was, it reminds me a little bit of the Drac Pack, which is an old TV show, a cartoon back when I was a kid in the 70s, or Mad Monster Party. All these kid versions of multiple monster movies. Even if you go back and watch The House of Dracula or House of Frankenstein, which were made in the 40s, they were horrifying terror movies then, but you know, they're so silly and goofy now. I like that bringing these characters into a more family-friendly audience because it's kind of fun that way. I remember reading comic books and watching cartoons of this stuff, and that's what this brings me back to. That's why I appreciated the first Hotel Transylvania. This one, actually, I think works a little bit better. Now, it's a little bit trite to say, well, the next movie is the kid is going to show up because they do that a lot in movies. That's a natural progression. You see this a lot in sequels, but in this one, the conflict, I think, is more genuine. It's Dracula wanting his grandson to be a monster, as opposed to trying to hide my daughter's boyfriend's humanness, which was kind of the MacGuffin for the first movie. And actually, what makes it work is the fact that there's a range of humor. There's slapstick, there's bathroom humor, there's the obnoxious stuff you'd expect from Adam Sandler and the gang, but there's also some really clever stuff. I took all three kids, ages 7 through 14. They all loved it. I had a blast. There was one joke in particular. It's Excite Gag, and it shows up. Me and my oldest son are the only two people in the theater that laughed, and we laughed loud. No one else seemed to have gotten that joke. That's good comedy writing, because there's a push from studios a lot of times to everyone has to get every single joke and we can't have anyone left behind. But a movie like this, you just throw a bunch of jokes at them and if 80% of them everybody gets is great, but that last 10-20% that only a few people will get, that's what makes it smart writing. That's why Mystery Science Theater was such a great show back in the 90s, because it didn't expect everyone to get every single joke. It said, wow, we wrote this one joke for like three people in our audience of a million people to get. Kind of adds value to it. It adds some smartness to the movie. And at the same time, then you can have the mummy farting or whatever. So Hotel Transylvania 2 is cute, and it's a great way to kick off Halloween. So Hotel Transylvania 2 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Intern. A retired widower takes a job as an intern at an e-commerce business and forges an unlikely friendship with his boss.
Hi, Jules. I'm Ben, your new intern.
I'm glad you also see the humor in this.
Be hard not to.
Don't feel like you have to dress up.
I'm comfortable in a suit if it's okay.
Old school.
At least I'll stand out.
I don't think you need a suit to do that.
Our investors just think that a seasoned CEO could take some things off your plate.
I did not see that coming.
You started this business all by yourself a year and a half ago. Remember who did that?
Now, of course, this is Robert De Niro. And what's great about this is Robert De Niro is playing completely against what he always would play, like especially in the 80s and 90s. I mean, I remember early to mid-90s, he made a movie and he was just playing just this average guy. And it was a big deal because he wasn't playing Al Capone or some big gangster. He was just playing a decent, regular human being. People always want to cast Robert De Niro as the heavy. And I think it's nice casting him as just the loyal, nice guy in this movie. He's very charming in it. And actually, him and Anne Hathaway, they both do a great job with the roles. And in lesser actors' hands, this would not have been as good of a movie. They really elevate these somewhat standard characters to a much higher plane. Now, this is directed by Nancy Myers, who is probably one of the best female directors out there. For as much hue and cry as people have been saying about female directors and needing more attention, I don't hear a whole lot of people championing Nancy Myers. And I think that's a shame because I think she's fantastic. Maybe it's because she essentially directs light comedies and rom-coms. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just because she's directing to what you'd expect her to direct, just because she's a chick directing chick flicks, does not mean that she's not worth talking about. Nancy Myers is a very talented director, and I've loved a lot of her films. I've liked pretty much everything I've seen. Even It's Complicated, but I think the reason I wasn't a wild about It's Complicated is because I don't like Meryl Streep all that much. But Nancy Myers does a great job with this movie, and it's essentially a rom-com, only there's no romance involved. Don't worry, this is not some weird, creepy sexual relationship between Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway. That's a very father-daughter type relationship. And they switch back and forth between mentor and mentee because, of course, she's showing him the ropes of the internet. He's showing her the ropes of how to deal with the world and how to give herself some pride. Now, there's some issues they try to deal with, like working mothers and women in the workplace and sexism in the workplace. And at times, Myers, who wrote the script as well, it seems that she's struggling with some of the issues that she went through personally because she used to be married to Charles Shire. And together, they directed Father of the Bride, but he took the credit for that. The Father of the Bride with Steve Martin and Diane Keaton 20 years ago. And what's funny is she blew up. Her once they got divorced, her career took off and she became a more notable director than he was. He kind of just pittered away and he never really did anything big after their union in terms of both as partnerships as in a marriage and in their career. So I think part of it is her reacting to that and the fact that she didn't think that she was given the just due for the work that she did. And you see that creeping in the movie. That's forgivable because she's the writer-director. You're going to get your own personal life involved at some time. But ultimately, the intern is really sweet and charming, and I really enjoyed it. It exists completely in fantasy. I mean, it's in this strange New York that has no homeless people and no traffic whatsoever, no matter what time of day it is. There's always complete. I mean, have you ever driven in New York? You can't drive in New York the way they drive in this movie. They just drive wherever they want to. It takes them 2 seconds. But it's still charming and cute, and it's not as much a antagonist-driven movie as it is more vignettes and this story of their relationship, of their friendship. It's a very sweet movie, and it's very charming. So I'm going to have to say The Intern rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I got two more movies to cover, two documentaries, Meet the Patels and Unbranded, plus the box office and the world-famous DVD roundup. Two, Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finishing up the show with a couple movie reviews left on the docket. These are documentaries. One of them is Meet the Patels. After breaking up with his white girlfriend, an Indian American allows his parents to try and find him a match with a nice Indian girl.
The story starts 2 years ago in L.A. I had just broken up with Audrey, and I was miserable. We'd been together for 2 years, and I had never told Mom and Dad about her. In fact, they were freaking out because, you know, here I was, almost 30, never married, which in our culture is like...
Code red.
Code red. Dad sent me 20 pictures and resumes of matrimonial candidates, which is totally normal. Within weeks, my biodata was in the hands of uncles, aunts, family, friends, and complete strangers.
I have a friend who is, he's Indian. I mean, he's from India, and he's in an arranged marriage. This guy is very, he's got a great sense of humor, and he's very Indian, but he's also very American. He kind of exhibits characteristics of both cultures, makes him very easy blending back and forth from his Indian roots and his just American life, because he's been here for decades. But he's in an arranged marriage, and it's funny to talk to him about it, because the whole arranged marriage thing really sets a lot of average Americans a little bit on edge. Also, the amount of, let's just say, ethnic centrism in relationships like this also goes against what we have grown to find as our ideals in America. I mean, if you watch this movie, the family's basically saying, oh, no, you have to marry an Indian girl. It can't be a white girl. And in fact, ideally should have this kind of skin color. And we're going to have an arranged marriage. Now, arranged marriage is not like, you know, you don't just go buy a bride at Walmart and say, well, there you go. There's a process. And that's, I think, that's the greatest thing that comes from this movie, is it opens up that process to fat, stupid Americans like myself who don't know how this thing works. And it's not just, hey, we found you a bride. Guess what? And we got a couple goats for her. Go out in the backyard and meet her. You're getting married at two. You know, that's not how it works. The family's involved and they pick the bride, and there's matchmaking going on, but there also needs to be consent between the parties. So this movie shows that, and it shows it in a very humorous way. This is directed by Ravi Patel, who is the main character in this, but it's also directed by Geeta Patel, who is his sister, and I think they both take a directing credit. But it's interesting to watch it because she's his sister, so of course she's constantly talking to him behind the camera, which technically you're not supposed to do, but it works for this film because it's her documenting this journey. And like I said, what it does is it takes you inside the process, and this is culture. This is what happens in a lot of Indian families. And you can watch this movie saying, gosh, I really need to show Fiddler on the Roof to these people. Tradition! You know, it's a look into a different culture that a lot of Americans don't understand or sometimes don't even know exists. And what's great about this movie is because both the directors are, they're Indian heritage-wise, but they're Americans. They've been in America and they've struggled with this whole arranged marriage and families and parents getting their paws into their relationships. They respect it, and it gives us a look at it, but it also presents it in a way that's very digestible to your average American. It's a great documentary. It's a lot of fun. It's got some great sense of humor. It's very respectful to its own culture, but it's also pointing out where it's kind of insane at times, you know, which every culture has its own insane things. And trust me, you know, this is a movie about family. And, you know, the person out there who does not have a crazy family can throw the first stone on this one. We all have insane people in our families. It's interesting to watch how much control the parents try to exert on him and how much pressure there is. But then again, that's everybody's family. But this is a good movie. Check it out. Even if you're not Indian, you know, go check it out because it's a neat movie. It's definitely worth seeing. Meet the Patels rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
The next movie I want to talk about is Unbranded. In order to show the worth of wild Mustangs, a cowboy tries to take a team of horses from the Mexican border to the Canadian border.
Good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. And sometimes that can be pretty horrific.
We recently adopted less than 3,000. What do we do with the excess wild horses that we have to remove?
Do these horses have a right to be here? Yeah, absolutely they do.
To prove the worth of these Mustangs, we're going to adopt, train, and ride them 3,000 miles from Mexico to Canada through the wildest terrain in the American West.
This is a movie which has a struggle figuring out what it's trying to do. Even now, after watching the film, my question is, what is the point of this movie? Because on one hand, it's the journey of self-discovery of these guys who take like 4 or 6 months to take their horses through the roughest, most natural terrain out there, sometimes very harrowing and dangerous situations. And you get to see what happens when you make, 4 or 5 people basically live together on horseback next to each other in such close quarters, and you see the drama that unfolds. On the other hand, is it about Mustangs? Is it about saving the wild horses? It has these cutaways. It cuts away to education about the Bureau of Land Management and how they're trying to manage the land and how there are wild horses out there on the land and how the wild horses are overpopulating the land, causing problems for ranchers and grazing. And is it sustainable? Which, by the way, before I even get into this, yes, there are wild horses in America. The problem is there aren't natural predators. And even though horses are not deer, they're essentially like deer. They are primary consumers who do not have natural predators. So if you let them just kind of go unchecked, they're going to explode and go into starvation and have serious problems. You know, back before this country was settled, there were a lot of deer, but there were also a lot of wolves out there, and the wolves would hunt the deer. And now that we've killed off a lot of the wolves, that's why you have deer populations that explode. That's actually why deer hunting in this country is a good thing, because it actually culls the herd. I mean, seriously, before deer season, you know, like in November, how many times you see dead deer on the side of the road because they're crossing the freeways because there's a lot of them. By the time you hit later in the fall, once Thanksgiving is hit, after you've had deer season, at least in Ohio, it's a lot thinner. But I don't know what Unbranded it's trying to do. I mean, it runs a little too long for it to be this interpersonal drama between these guys, and it sometimes gets a little petty. It's beautiful. It's gorgeously shot. It just shows the backcountry of our great nation, and that's wonderful. But it really has a focus problem in terms of story and narrative. So I have to say, Unbranded, as beautiful as it looks, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I predicted $32 million for Maze Runner. People were predicting way more than me. Some people were predicting upwards of $40 million, which I thought was ridiculous. And it turns out it was. In the weekend actuals, I was actually ahead of the game. I said $32 million. It made just over $30 million. That's fine for what it is, but it is, it's a downturn from the last movie, which is not a good thing, because the third one may suffer some steeper drop as well. And that's the same thing that's happening with the Divergent series. And then Black Mass did 22.5, which is good, but the real surprises came from Everest, which made over $7 million, came in fifth, when it was only in like 545 theaters, which is kind of impressive, considering it was just in an IMAX release. It was a bona fide IMAX release that actually made money and got on the scoreboard. Now, Captive didn't do well at all. It made not even $1.5 million, which is kind of embarrassing. Now, this week, Hotel Transylvania 2 is going to win. I don't think anyone's disputing that, but by how much? Now, the first one made in the upper 30 millions. I think this is going to be $40 million. I think this is going to do remarkably well. There really isn't anything for kids out there at all. I mean, if you look at the top 10 movies, none of them are movies that kids are going to go see. I mean, it's the Maze Runner, yeah, I guess. But I mean, I'm talking kid movies. That's teen movie. This is kids movies. Kids and families, they're going to push this. This thing's going to do pretty well. And you're not going to have the Adam Sandler effect that you had with Pixels. Maze Runner, I think, is going to take a huge nosedive. I think it's going to be dropping 60% or more, mainly because I think it's burned off its demand. I think Everest could beat The Intern, but I think The Intern's going to do better, again, for competition in the marketplace. There really isn't a female-centric movie out there. I mean, for just a light romance, a comedy that will be perceived as a chick flick, there's not one out there. I think it's going to do remarkably well. It's going to, I think, do better than the 16 or 17 million people are predicting. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. The only brand new release is Pitch Perfect 2, which I thought was okay. I thought it was a step down from the first one. Nothing against Elizabeth Banks. I just didn't think it was as strong of a movie. It felt very American Pie 2-ish in terms of a sequel. Then there's a bunch of re-releases that are hitting Blu-ray or Criterion. Moonrise Kingdom is hitting Criterion. Go Wes Anderson. I love those movies. And then the Rocky Horror Picture Show is getting a 40th anniversary release just in time for Halloween. There's also The Sentinel and Madhouse from Scream Factory. Madhouse being the one with Vincent Price from the 70s, not the one with John Larroquette and Kirstie Alley from the 90s. And then finally from TV, you've got Arrow Season 3 and Flash Season 1. That is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Ridley Scott's The Martian and The Walk. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.